kind of guys who'd make you feel like that. Oh no!
Hello and welcome to Today in Digital Education, episode 78. And this one we're titling The Random Show. I'm Doug Belshaw and this is...
Randomly, Di Barnes.
How are you doing, Di?
I'm all right, thank you very much. I had a long, long day. So I started teaching at 8:30 with meetings, training during lunch hour, then got to 5 o'clock, 4 to 5, finished teaching, then had 2 hours of tutorials, then 30 minutes of supper with the children. And now I'm here.
Very good.
BIA, and that's after reports have been done. So flipping heck.
Congratulations. So we're recording this on the evening of Thursday, the 16th of March. And yeah, so we haven't done a podcast for a couple of weeks now, just because it's difficult with schedules and things. But here we are, and I pasted loads of links in, and we couldn't really find a theme, so we're just calling this The Random Show. And yeah, we're going to ramble through some things which are of interest. And as Di, what did you say? You said that we should probably focus on stuff that we don't usually do.
Yeah, so we talk a lot about tech corps, privacy, open, things like that, and so we're just focusing on ones that aren't necessarily about that, which I think is a good thing. Tell me how your 2 weeks have been since we last spoke.
Yeah, good. So where have I been? I've been to Dublin, and we did some work. So Brian Mathers and I did some work through the co-op with the National Council for Curriculum and Assessment in Ireland, and they're thinking about using badges for their junior cycle, so kind of 16-year-olds, I guess. Mm-hmm. And also with short courses, that kind of stuff. So did some great work, and we wrote that up, actually, so I should probably dig out that blog post. What else have I done? Done quite a bit of writing, and I did a book sprint. I think I mentioned I was going to do that.
Yeah, you did. How was that?
That was really interesting. So not loads of people there, but that wasn't the point. The point was not for it to be a large event, but for it to be focused on using this particular platform by Source Fabric called BookType, and it's all about collaboratively creating a book using this platform. And you know, there's some really interesting design features in there. And Source Fabric, who make this particular product, they specialize in open source products for journalists. So really interesting people there. The guy who founded the company was there. One of the trainers kind of was there. Interesting people from kind of the art scene in the Northeast. I was there. I was helping facilitate. Went out for curry in the evening. And it's the first event I've been at, even when I was working for Mozilla, really, where there were more Linux laptops than anything else.
You're joking, really?
Seriously, yeah.
So there's clearly a sort of self-selecting audience of sorts. Mm-hmm. In that's really interesting. So it's the open source thing that's coming with that, yeah?
Yeah, definitely. So we ended up, we had to create this ebook, and this particular platform, the main customer for it is Amnesty International. So Amnesty published all these different reports all the way around the world in local versions, and previously they would, you know, do the old-fashioned way of doing things with Microsoft Word documents and stuff. So they now use this platform, and because it's all based on HTML, they can then just export it into whatever format they want. So you need a version ready to go at the printers? There you go. You need a version in EPUB or Kindle or whatever? There you go. Really easy to churn out from a single source. So what they were saying was that they do all the proofs, you know, online, collaboratively, together, wherever it is in the world. And then they do a print-on-demand version for the launch. And then inevitably, there's errors which are spotted when there's more eyes on it. And then they do the final finished print run 2 weeks after the launch.
Oh, okay.
Mm.
Wow.
I thought it was very interesting. Mm-hmm. And what it's allowed them to do is to bring their cycle of reporting. It's made it be able to be faster. So instead of just doing one major report a year, I think they do 2 or 3. So,
okay.
So for me, it was a perfect example of technology literally being able to change the organization in terms of collaboration, speed of reporting, impact, in terms of getting information out to their supporters, because there's obviously millions of supporters of Amnesty around the world.
Yeah, completely. That's very interesting that they're doing that.
Mm. So that was interesting. We created a book using the platform. We just had to create a book. And so we kind of circled around for ages. We had about 7 hours to do it, and it went up to 6 o'clock in the evening before we went out for the curry. And the thing, at my suggestion, that we focused on after a long conversation was on the concept of notability, which seems a bit random. But you know, on Wikipedia, you might not know this, but and certainly people who are listening might not. There's two camps on Wikipedia, two kind of mindsets, a bit like in education, people say there's like the traditionalists and the progressives, yeah? And the two camps on Wikipedia are the inclusionists and the deletionists. Have you come across this before?
No.
So the inclusionists say, hey, look, this isn't like a paper encyclopedia. We can put literally everything ever on it. Whereas the deletionists say, no, there has to be quality standards. And, you know, we can't spread everybody so thinly that, you know, nothing ever gets finished and we don't get the quality that we need. And from what I understand, it's the deletionists who are in the ascendancy. So there's quite stringent notability guidelines in terms of who and what gets a page on Wikipedia. So you have to meet certain notability guidelines. So we wondered what that would look like as applied to certain characters in the Northeast. And there's plenty of people in the Northeast who would be notable locally, but wouldn't meet Wikipedia's guidelines. So we ended up writing a book, which, because of Creative Commons licensing and being able to copy and paste stuff and using things under a license, we managed to put together a 40-page book in 7 hours. Some original content, lots of, you know, copied and pasted and attribution. And it was about famous inventors and people from the Northeast, according to Wikipedia. And then it was like people who we would include, some quite random people just for fun.
Interesting. That's really interesting, because the idea that you can go and manipulate sources to increase somebody's right or authorization to do something in such a way, it's really fascinating. You know, it's like proper work. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's making something happen.
And some of the characters we came across, I mean, there's ones who are alive now who I was concerned that some of the people who were being mentioned were borderline mentally ill and we were poking fun at them. But after finding out more about them, because I didn't know who these people were, it turns out that one guy is an evangelical Christian who just dances with his headphones on to get attention and then preaches the gospel. And he's well known because he does all this kind of stuff in metro stations throughout the Northeast. And then historically, I don't know if you've ever seen a picture which is hanging in the Lang Art Gallery called The Great Day of His Wrath by John Martin, not the guitarist and composer. Mm-hmm. It's an amazing painting, a huge, huge kind of thing. The thing you can stand in front of for ages, of Sodom and Gomorrah, the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. Mm-hmm. And I've actually got a massive print of it in my house, which my wife won't let me put up. Anyway, his brother was like a celebrated inventor and invented an even better version of the Davy lamp for miners. But he was also extremely eccentric and didn't believe in gravity, and wore a tortoiseshell hat in case of danger.
Wow, a tortoiseshell hat.
Mm.
That's something I've not seen before.
Yeah. So, you know, I learned lots and lots of stuff about all kinds of things. And obviously you're doing it with a bit of fun and all that kind of stuff. But learned lots about the Northeast and people that I didn't know about before. So it was all good.
Excellent. Excellent. Mm. It's an interesting thing. I attended this conferencey thing this week on school leadership, and there was talk there of how difficult schools, independent schools in the North, are finding it right now because of austerity measures and such like, and people feeling the pinch and whatever. And it's just sort of bringing home to me, because I've not lived in the North for a long, long time. I'm in the Midlands now, and. It's, you kind of forget the difference between the North and the South to a degree. Do you know what I mean? So it was interesting to be reminded of that, and what you've just been saying reminds me again.
In what sense is Peterborough the Midlands?
It's the East Midlands. That's what it is.
south. Anything south of the...
Shut up, man. It's a fact. It's not a flipping...
If you're south of Doncaster, you're in the south. Anyway, not to split... Yeah, okay. So, yes, that's what I've been doing. So, was that conference good?
Yeah, someone stepped out of it and the school had paid for the ticket, so I thought I'll just take it. You know, I wasn't teaching much that day, so I thought I'd take it up, which was a huge mistake since I had all my reports due in 11 o'clock the next morning. and so we couldn't do Tide on Tuesday. But was it good? I don't know. So it was interesting. There was a guy there talking about how he had gone into leadership and I'm not a very ambitious individual, you know what I mean? I've never sort of set my sights. I know people who, you know, want to be ahead by the time they're 50, and I've never really thought about it, and I'm not really sure that I'm cut out for school senior management in certain ways. And in other ways, I think I'd be a real asset to any leadership team. So for me, it's kind of a question of whether I go into that formal route. I enjoy the job I do. I still teach a lot. I deal with technology. I deal with it in a way that's different to other people, and I like that.
Good.
So just sort of reflecting on that, seeing some people who've made that transition and reflecting their reflections. But it was interesting.
I think being ambitious is overrated, to be honest. And it's all about other people's agenda for your life, isn't it, really?
It is. For me, it's kind of like, you know, making the step into, I mean, I have a sort of assistant head type post anyway, but it's not called that, so I don't feel like I'm involved in it in that way, and that I have to climb any ladders. You know, I just don't feel that that's a necessity for me in my life. I've got nothing to prove. I'm much more about things like that. So, but equally, I think, you know, I work in a very wealthy, endowed, endowment independent school, but I was born in the state sector, grew up in the state sector, taught in the state sector for 10 years, and I kind of feel like I might have a lot to offer, and that's something I should do, really. And but then do you know what I mean? But if you can go and make a difference. But then I see people that I know and respect going into headship and really struggling and finding it tough and not enjoying the job.
Well, I think there's a bit of a crisis actually with head teachers at the moment, isn't there?
Quite possibly.
I know in Northumberland something like a third of head teachers are retiring at the end of this year.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Oh. Which is a bit... it's really difficult, isn't it? So it's very different in the independent sector being ahead to being ahead in the state sector, and it's to do with... it's to do with a lot of factors.
Well, my dad was always deputy head, and I don't think he ever went for a headship. I can't remember him ever, you know, applying for a headship or going away for an interview or anything like that. And he did that for 19 years? No, for 17 years, something like that.
Mm. Oh, I mean, part of it for me, I think, is, I mean, I'm not, is it, yeah, I just see too many situations that have made me cry. Make me squirm and make me feel pressure that I don't really need to or want to have in my life. So
I think that's fair enough.
So I don't know. So I'm sort of thinking about it. That's all. But it was decent. The insight was decent. I didn't pay. What the hell? Okay.
The other thing, talking about my dad, actually, he went into hospital, had a heart operation on Tuesday. So he's now a cyborg.
Is he really? That's quite interesting. Coincidentally, my father was in the hospital for an operation on his heart, not on his heart, but connected to his heart, which is the rest of his body, I guess. just last week. So he's had a little thing put in to trace his, to collect data, his heart data, basically, which will be collected every 3 months, should last for 2 years because he's been fainting a couple of times and no one really knows why.
Oh, that's interesting, because my dad's got something similar. It's a pacemaker which stops sudden cardiac death syndrome. But the interesting thing for me is that it syncs. He's got a little computer which has to sit next to his bed. So this operation, I couldn't believe it. So it was actually 3 hours long. It took 45 minutes, and he was the healthiest I've ever seen him when I went to see him that night. Anyway, he could have gone home that day, the same day of the operation, but he stayed in overnight.
Yeah. Was it general? Anesthetic?
No, he was awake during it.
All right. Mine too. Yeah.
So, which is great. And he's now got, you know, like when you sync with your Fitbit data, he's now got a computer next to his bed which syncs with his heart and then transmits the data via mobile data signal to the hospital.
Wow. So if anyone wants to intercept Doug's dad's heart information, there it will be.
Well, being the loving kind son that I am, I did remind him that on there was one episode or one series of 24, which we've both seen, where the deputy prime minister's heart is remote, his pacemaker is remotely activated and it causes a heart attack.
Yeah, they do that trick as well on Homeland. The series of Homeland, and where someone goes and Wi-Fi's into the heart, the pacemaker, to kill the guy without anybody knowing it was them, thinking it was a faulty.
Oh, it might have been Homeland actually. I might have got that wrong. Oh, yeah.
Well, fair play. So I had a long conversation. My father came down with my mum to. We went out for supper for my birthday, and just before he went in for this operation, and we had this conversation about the Fitbit, actually, in the heart monitor version as well. And I said, you know, they're going to collect your data every 3 months. And are you ever going to get to see that data? Are you ever going to get to see what the information that is making the decisions? Which I don't know if your father is going to have access to his data or not.
I'm not sure.
And I said, if you get a Fitbit, I said, you can do the steps thing. And I said, you know, it's whatever it is. And you can just – basically, you gather information. You have that information, and you can interpret that. And you can make decisions about how you lead your life based on that data rather than somebody else telling you or having to wait for 3 months until you have access to it and things like that. And I said, it might be something that you really enjoy doing. And so, and he's up to it. So I'm gonna sort him out.
Okay. My wife's got one of those Fitbits with a heart rate monitor, and she couldn't run for a while because of her knee, and she was in physio. Actually, the hospital physio 3 times a week for her knee.
That's a lot.
Yeah, and apparently most people give up because it's such a hassle, but she actually stuck the whole course until she was discharged. And so she showed me her heart rate history from early 2015, then she stopped running in the summer, then obviously it was hot in the summer, and, you know, we were just, you know, not doing exercise and camping and whatever. And there was a huge variation in her heart, and then she started running again at the start of the year. And seriously, like, you can see, as soon as she started running again, 2 or 3 times a week, her heart rate dropped to below 60, a resting heart rate.
Wow, there you go. So that's one of the things I said to my dad. I said, you know, you believe, I said, what you do at the moment. So my mum says there are days that he spends just sitting in the office of being quite sedentary. And he said, no, that's not the case. I'm always out and about doing things and like running errands and working in the garden on the house and stuff like that. And I said, well, you've got different bits of information here. From both of you, so it's like if you have this data, you can discuss the information that data gives you, and you know that if you haven't done, like if you've had a sedentary day, like a good 3 mile walk would be pretty awesome, or if you've had a reasonably okay day, a walk down to the village would be awesome. They'd pick up a newspaper.
No, I think that's important. I've been trying to catch up with the Audrey Waters and Ken Lane's podcast. They've recently changed it from Tech Gypsies to Contra Fabulous. So I subscribe to so many podcasts, I just can't keep up with them. But I listened to the last one, which is under their Tech Gypsies kind of branding. And they were talking about data in the world of Trump and how people collect data, which they might never need, but obviously it can be either intercepted or requested or whatever. So, you know, when you were talking about to your dad about, you know, do you ever get to see this data? It's really important that the person themselves gets to see the analytics data or whatever it is, because otherwise it's a bit stalkerish, isn't it? It's a bit surveillance kind of oriented.
Yeah. In your own interest, potentially. Mm. Yeah.
But, you know, it does help change behavior. So even today, we've got one car. I need to go and pick up a friend's son, take him to football. It was going to clash with Hannah needing the car. She looked at her Fitbit and was like, actually, I need to do loads of steps. So I tell you what, you know, Grace and I'll walk and you can have the car. Whereas that would have been a bit of an argument about who was having the car otherwise, which is interesting, isn't it?
Well, it is. I mean, and especially in lives that are so or feel so busy these days, and which you're full in the thick of when you've got two young children like you do, is that you forget to make those decisions, don't you? Make those calls. It's like, actually, no, I've got loads to do. I've got supper to make. I've got clothes to iron, whatever, you know. So you don't make the decision that's actually in your interests and that would be an enjoyable thing to do, really. You pick the path of least resistance.
Yeah.
Get in the car for a minute's drive down the shops.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, it's just what you do. So it's good. And I think that's what it's all about, isn't it?
It is. Oh, this week, actually, just to kind of get us into the show notes and stuff, one thing I've been looking for, I guess, is the next big thing for me to work on. So I wrote my thesis, digital literacies, worked on open badges for Mozilla, the kind of the web literacy map. And whilst I've really enjoyed doing lots of different kinds of things while I've been a consultant, I haven't really had anything meaty enough to get my teeth into. And also at the start of the year, a book publisher, I think I mentioned this, a book publisher approached me and said, you know, would you like to write some for us? If you could put together a proposal on anything you'd like, then we'll definitely consider it and we'd love to have you as an author, which I was very flattered by. But I was wondering why I haven't yet written the proposal. And the reason for it is because I don't want to just rehash all the stuff I've done before. But I realized at the start of this week that one thing that I'm really interested in is what it means to be employable in this new world which we live in, where people aren't necessarily employees but they still need to be employable for like short-term contracts and things. Mm-hmm. So kind of employability skills, also kind of digital literacies broadly speaking, and also obviously alternative credentialing and open badges. And so I wrote a post, what does it mean to be digitally employable, to go with a book proposal I'm writing at the moment around kind of digital employability, because I feel like it's of the moment in terms of the zeitgeist, but it's also lots of employability skills are just framed as being old school collaboration in whatever form you want to do it, or being punctual, whereas actually I feel like there's a whole swathe of skills and competencies and knowledge and behaviors that people need to be successful. So I want to explore that, and I'm looking at ways in which I can not only just write the book but kind of do more than that. So I'm thinking with the co-op people about that at the moment.
Okay. I think that's a really interesting idea, because it's the whole thing, isn't it, about, I mean, I've had this chatter a lot of times through my professional career about qualifications and how they lead to employability and the attempts by exam boards to link up with government departments of business and such like, and to bring employers, to get the big employers around the table and to ask them what it is that they want so that the qualifications can be designed to help them, to help skilled young people come into the workforce and get the jobs that are out there. So I think that's a really interesting, I mean, it's potentially mammoth, but it's also an important thing to sort of keep simple and make relevant to today's world.
Well, the thing that really nailed it for me was, you know, being over in Dublin, so last Friday, and again, everyone likes examples, use the example of Sussex Downs College employability passport, which I have done for the last year, I guess.
Uh-huh.
And every time I put it on the screen, no matter what size the audience, so on Friday it was a think-a-thon, so it's a small group, three people at their end, you know, two of us doing it, or it's a hall of hundreds of people. Whenever I put this slide up, people start taking photographs of it. And I thought, well, why is that? And, you know, it's good work, it's got three levels to it, all this kind of stuff. But it doesn't, and it's got really interesting things in terms of they've worked with businesses and all this thing I've talked about before. So it's a great piece of work, but I wouldn't say that it's done by experts in the field. I wouldn't say that it doesn't focus on digital stuff very much. So it's got a badge for digital literacy, but mm-hmm. nothing else in terms of digital stuff. So I just thought there was a huge opportunity there. So
hang on, let me stop you. So why do you think these people are looking at this thing and taking the pictures? Why do you think they're doing that?
I honest I think the first thing is something Brian Mathers talks about is cognitive ease.
Mm-hmm.
So cognitive ease is, does this look like something which is important? All right. Now, I shared something on Twitter the other day, which was off the back of some really bad UNESCO framework that someone had shared saying, this is really good. And it wasn't really good. It was crap. But it was colorful.
Uh-huh.
And it looked like a wheel. And people were, when I was, sometimes you tweet something out and somebody retweets something so fast that you know that they haven't read it.
Yeah.
And so many people are retweeting stuff or favoriting stuff. You thought, no, you haven't read this and you're just doing it because it looks pretty. Now, I'm certainly not saying the Sussex Downs and College stuff is they're doing because it just looks pretty, but it does look good. And it's got three levels and you can tell that they've obviously thought about this. But I think that the reason people like being able to just take things off the shelf.
True, isn't it? So that's essentially what they say. People see this diagram, see this sort of thought assemble, but it's the diagram that they're going for, and they think that is an artifact. That thing there is an artifact that I can pick up and place down in my own work, possibly share back in my own organization or network.
Mm.
And it makes sense. And it's also about something really important, which is employability.
Now, the thing which I tried to do when I was at Mozilla is do, so you know when you go in a browser and you go to view source and mm-hmm. you can see all the HTML and CSS and everything like that, you can see what the page was made from.
Yeah.
So that is, especially in Mozilla, was used as a metaphor for everything. And I wrote a post, which I've actually linked to in this one about employability. I put, we need view source for digital literacy frameworks because otherwise you don't know how the process by which it was made. And you need to know the process by which it was made because if you say, well, hang on, it's missing this thing here. There might be a very good reason why it's missing that thing. We might have had the whole discussion about it and decide to leave it out or it's part of this other thing. And you need to be able to click view source and go in and find out who made the decisions and why. And, if you find out it was made by, a bunch of white guys in their 30s and 40s, then you start thinking, oh, well, maybe they've got blinkers on and they don't see some things which are important in different sectors or whatever it's going to be. I feel like you need to know.
By those people, and yet, but if you can see the thinking behind what they've done, then you can verify it. So it might be that you think that, but these, it's you and me that sat around a table and made this thing. Mm. But actually, if the thinking behind it is available, then people can say, well, that actually isn't relevant because this is why they've done what they've done.
Exactly. So the equivalent of this in politics would be the very intelligent, fresh-faced, early 20s policy analyst for a think tank who writes a report by themselves, which is then taken up by the press and by government ministers and taken as gospel.
Yeah, absolutely. Weapons of mass destruction.
Yeah. So I think it's really important that, you do these things in the open, that you document why and how you came up with this. Now, I think Kev and the team at Sussex Downs College could easily do that because I think that they've got all of that stuff and they've written blog posts about it and whatever. It's just that it's not the normal thing that you do when you're doing this kind of work, whereas I think it's a really important thing to do. So what I'd like to do is to come up with a digital employability framework where you can deconstruct it and you can fork it and you can see why decisions have been made. But of course it's not, I'm going to knock that out tomorrow.
Obviously. There's interesting, sitting in the shadows of our conversation really is the idea of working openly.
Mm.
This is what it is, isn't it? I'm reminded of the work that you did with the Web Literacy Map at Mozilla, community calls, wikis, sources of information and ideas that are crowdsourced. Laura's Hilliger's work. Hello, Laura, if you're listening, at Greenpeace and the way that she forced through and perseveres with the idea of community and collaboration and having all of that stuff out there and leaving it out there for people to go and retrace should they wish to.
And the difficulty is the thing that you produce at the end looks pretty similar. And it's a bit like that African proverb, which is, if you want to go fast, go alone. But if you want to go far, go together. And you see so many different frameworks and whatever grids pop up and then just die and wither because they've got nothing behind them.
I think this is true. I tell you one of the things that I think is interesting. Have you done yourself indeed a sort of teaching and learning strategy for a school?
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not something that we would have here. And I think it's quite interesting that that's the sort of, you know, you see the fancy wheel kind of thing sitting on the top.
Or the TPAC thing, yeah.
Oh, well, whatever it might be. It's just like, you know, this is how we teach at our school,
yeah,
kind of thing. But this is the problem with these sorts of things, in my opinion, especially in teaching and learning, is that they become prescriptive. And then people start narrowing what they do because they are trying to fit it into somebody else's wheel.
Well, it's also done to people as well, isn't it?
Yeah. But it's just that sort of thing. If you can unpack the history of how that thing was arrived at, and it's like an iceberg, you know, and there's masses of information. But I guess in schools, I mean, that's what meeting minutes are supposed to be. But very few people actually go and retrace the steps through minutes.
No, exactly. And there's different ways of doing it, especially in this day and age, I think. And the thing is, the worst example of creating records is when people create an audit trail to be like, to bully people into submission because they're more organized than everyone else. And I've seen that in lots of different organizations.
Yeah, but, yeah, absolutely.
But, and almost threatening people with like, oh, and that's nominated. But the best way of doing that is things being available to go back and say, oh, why did we make that decision? Even if you might never have to do that. It's just the fact that you're documenting the whole process. Now, yeah. We could go on about this, but I think, you know, you talk about the teaching and learning strategy. Mm. I feel like, sorry, go on.
Well, no, it's the principle of the process being open affects the people who are involved in the process. I mean, that's the point, isn't it? It's like the fact that you're having to document your journey affects how people take their steps. You know, that's the deal, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. I'm going to do this book proposal. I've only shared it on our Slack channel at the moment, mainly because I know that the people on that channel know me and my work rather than just like doing a drive-by comment on stuff. Uh-huh. And I guess I've learned the places from which I value feedback as opposed to, I'm just going to stick it on Twitter. And then, you know, although I do enjoy working openly, someone just goes, oh, I'll just take that, rip that off and not, you know, and yeah, I'm a bit more aware of that stuff these days.
The thing is you need to have gain some traction, don't you, to the ideas in your own mind and all that sort of thing.
Yeah, that's true.
You have something that's established and you're talking about a book proposal. Who you're proposing that to, I'm not sure, whether you're looking for someone to sponsor you to write it and a publisher or whatever, or whether you're just looking to build some traction to it. And that takes layers of convincing yourself before you commit yourself to a lot of work. Do you know what I mean?
No, it does. And yeah, we'll see how it goes. And I'll keep everyone updated. But yeah, cool. If you are a publisher or you know one, I'm certainly not just going to take the first thing that pops up. So do get in touch if you think this sounds interesting and you are a publisher or know someone who knows stuff about this. Cool. Right. In the last couple of weeks, the University of California, Berkeley, announced that they are going to remove 20,000 university lectures. You see this?
No.
So there's all kinds of shenanigans happening in the US, as we know at the moment, under the Trump administration, and organizations that have to lean with it and change with the wind and the times, like universities, because of the kind of the public nature of them and the way that they're structured and stuff, for better or for worse. They had this commitment to open access of lectures, and they were taken to task for the fact that these lectures did not meet accessibility guidelines because they didn't have subtitles, etc. So they were told that they had to be made accessible, and that was going to be too much, so they decided to pull them. And interestingly, on the announcement, it does say something along the lines of, oh, and people were pirating them and doing all kinds of stuff with them anyway, so it's for the best.
Mm-hmm. But what's happened? Something quite radical has happened, really.
Yeah, so there's a blockchain startup called Libry, LBRY, and they're just about to launch, actually. I got an email this week saying that, hey, if you've got a GitHub account, you can get a certain amount of credit. It's a bit like Bitcoin. I'll tell you a story about Bitcoin in a moment, actually, where you get a cryptocurrency, and it's all based off that kind of blockchain ledger kind of stuff. And so what they did was they took all 20,000 university lectures before they were pulled, and they've put them, and they've made them available for free via LBRY in a way that's irrevocable because it's on the blockchain.
I'm trying to go to the library, but it's not there. It's not opening.
So Library is, it's got its own protocol. So you know, like you have HTTP or HTTPS, right. It's got its own protocol, which is LBRY, you know, ///
Yeah.
So you have to have it installed so that it recognizes that kind of link.
Oh, I see. Okay. So it doesn't work. If you're command line capable but new to Library, follow this guide. Cool. So this is a really interesting concept. Now, what's not quite clear here between the sort of mixed messages coming out from Barclay and so this thing says, the title of this Library article is 20,000 world-class university lectures made illegal. So we have changed that. They've made them available. And so Barclay were probably a bit pissed off that their lectures were made illegal, declared illegal, you know, and declared these are not satisfactory. And so it's not necessarily that Library are going against Barclay's wishes here. It's just that they're taking control away from the legal system of one country and publishing it to the world, which is sort of what the web does, really.
Well, yeah, exactly. The web is a giant photocopy machine, and then the day, as Cory Doctorow says. And there is a bit where it says, is this legal? It says, almost certainly. The vast majority of the lectures are licensed under a Creative Commons license that allows attributed non-commercial redistribution. The price for this content has been set to free, and all LBRY metadata attributes it to UC Berkeley. Additionally, we believe that this content is legal under the First Amendment. Free speech.
Mm. It's interesting. There's lots of complicated little variables in here. So two students from another university under the Americans with Disabilities Act brought the case that made this lawsuit that made these illegal. So I'm just trying to think the principle that they'd be made legal. Should they be taken off the market? Should they be taken out of the public domain? Because they do not have equality of access, or is it a good thing? I just don't really know how to.
It's difficult, isn't it? Let me just use something which is kind of, it's not an exact analog, but it does remind me of something that happened to me this week. So two things, actually. Let me just say, first of all, there's been a massive surge on cryptocurrencies recently. So I more than doubled my money that I put into cryptocurrencies last year.
All right, well done.
Yeah. So I bought, I saw Ethereum was going to be a big thing. So I had to take some more dividends out of my business. And so I bought a big bit of painting that I talked about last year, but also put just £100 into Ethereum. And when I came back to it saying, oh, massive surge, it was on £287.
All right, okay, fair play. Yeah. Very sensible thing to invest your money in, I would say.
Anyway, so that's that. Anyway, so I got an email yesterday, this person at a new service called RevoiceMe. And I thought, that's interesting. It says, my name is Yuka, the founder of Revoice, a tool that delivers your newsletter on Facebook Messenger or any chat platform. We've created your page, not like, would you like to do this? We've created your page at revoice.me/thoughtshrapnel, where anyone can subscribe to the Thought Shrapnel newsletter on Facebook Messenger or other messaging apps like Telegram and stuff.
Yeah.
So my first reaction was like, you bastards. but then I thought, no, let's just have a look at this. So basically what it is, you connect your Telegram account or Facebook Messenger or Slack, and it'll notify you when I've sent up a new newsletter. You click through and you can view my content. Now, this isn't entirely new, because there's a website called newsletter.me where people can view my newsletter through their platform. Now, the person behind that platform is extremely nice and very approachable and is sympathetic to the fact that I actually want people's email addresses, because, you know, at the end of the day, it's a marketing tool for me, as well as the fact that, you know, I like communicating that medium.
Uh-huh.
Whereas this guy's just gone, boom, there you go. So I was like, hey, you know, the cynic in me would say that you're profiting from my content, but I might have missed something here. And he was like, oh, no, it's just a delivery channel. All the subscribers are yours, and the content, the links and the ads and everything. And I was like, well, hang on a minute. If people subscribe to my newsletter through your tool, how do I get their email address? And he's like proper patronizing. Well, here's the thing. Facebook Messenger works so that you get all of their details. And I'm like, yeah, that would be awesome if I had a Facebook account. Remove my newsletter. Boom. and so he did remove it. I just thought that that was the wrong way of going about that.
Well, it's quite, I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? So there are lots of people making stuff out there on the web, like services and like that. This is a good example. And trying to make their way and trying to build, you have to build traction. You have to build a certain fingerfall, you know. And so how you do that and how aggressive you are with that system. So he's kind of thinking, I've just done all this stuff for you, and it makes your newsletter so much more accessible to so many more people. It's going to be a great thing. You're going to love it. And then you kind of say, well, the devil's in the detail. Give me the detail. Oh, that's not the detail I want. Thank you.
Yeah.
Goodbye. And it's fair. But I don't think, he could have approached it in a different way, maybe.
Mm-hmm. I did kind of go along with it. And then it didn't actually work when I tried it. So bollocks. Anyway, yeah, I think it's a bit cheeky. It's all, as you said, devil's in the detail.
There's no question about that. But it is in the detail of what is good for you, and, interesting.
Okay. Well, I'm trying to think of a link here to the next link, but this is the random show, so there isn't really one.
Excellent, good link.
This is a guy who works for Dropbox. It says in his bio on Medium that he was at YouTube and Google. John Saito.
Saito, yeah.
And he talks about, so it's the magic of microcopy. Delight is in the details. And I don't know if you had a chance to look at this, but he goes through, and I always like it when people give screenshots and examples of what they're talking about rather than just, talking in the abstract, although I could be accused of that quite often. It gives examples from Yelp and Vimeo and, his own product, which is Dropbox and Tumblr and things. And he talks about, how you can be informal and how you can add a bit of magic into it. Like, there's one bit where someone signs up to OkCupid and you put in your location and someone's put London, then it just auto pops up underneath, London. And
this is really interesting. So I've watched this trend over years, which started with WordPress. You know how WordPress has those little hellos, howdy dog, howdy die, and in different languages and things like that. And it's kind of annoying and cute all at the same time. But there's a way that these platforms are becoming a little bit more informal, a little bit more jokey, a little bit more sunshiny, and so that when people use them, they have that kind of feeling. So the language that's used now, I find it hard to Google are good at this sort of thing. So like when something's not working, it seems to be broke at the moment or something like that, sort of casual human text kind of.
Yeah, not just like 404 broken.
Yeah, exactly. Just something that's a little bit more, when things are buffering and stuff like that. And I think it's a good thing, and it's just nice, I think.
Well, this guy talks about, where is it? He says something like there's 27,000 lines of writing, or 27,000 sentences within Dropbox. Which is crazy, isn't it?
27,000 sentences within Dropbox? What does that mean?
It says, believe it or not, Dropbox has over 20,000 27,000 messages in its interface. 27,000. By comparison, the first...
Blinking heck, really?
The first Harry Potter book has a little over 6,600 sentences.
Wowee, that's a good comparison. Is that in here? That's amazing.
And he says, so where the heck are all these messages? Well, they show up everywhere, from the top of your browser to the alt tags in each image. Each message has an opportunity to delight, and a good writer will sweat the details for each and every message.
Oh, wow, this is the new sort of greetings card thing, isn't it? So examples here, there's a star rating system for restaurants on Yelp.
Yep.
And one star is, eek, methinks not. And five stars is, woohoo, as good as it gets. And a variety in between. And that's kind of cool, because it just represents your internalized thoughts a little bit, maybe, or the thing that you might say if you were actually talking to your thing.
And there's a couple of examples towards the bottom. My favorite ones, I think, are, I always like using MailChimp, just because it makes me smile. And the little example here is, Basecamp's footer has a friendly message that changes depending on the day of the week. So the example here says, enjoy the rest of your Monday when you log out. And there's a conference here. It says, the design/content conference site has delightful alt tags like Eileen Webb smiling at you and wearing a warm scarf.
Yeah, well, it's interesting, isn't it? So this is the sort of thing that gets tired pretty quick. So that the skill of making it not tired is really, really valuable, I think. Yeah. Like picking it carefully so that it doesn't annoy you and it feels like you're doing something human rather than...
Do you get my newsletter?
Yeah, of course I do.
I'm not assuming anything. Do you ever read the bottom bit, which is about me?
Go on, remind me and I'll tell you.
It says, like, Doug Balshaw is a consultant and does this, whatever. Some people say, like, almost like the Stig.
All right, yes, yes.
So I change that every week.
Yes.
No, and I used to put a secret, like, link that only some people found and things. People love that.
Well, yeah, exactly. So I used to do training videos. And I would put them out, and there would be a little Easter egg in it. So I'd put, like, a picture of one of the staff in it, or a film star, and people would have to email me, and the first email got a chocolate bar with whatever film star, and you had to name the character in the film, not the film star, and that kind of thing. But all the techies would always just use bloody Google to find the picture.
Yeah.
They'd crop it and then put it into Google. But that kind of thing, people really like that. So it's like, I'm watching this for work, but there's something else to it, and it's kind of nice.
Hmm. But like you say, it's about the human side of it, the fact that this hasn't just been churned out by a machine.
Yeah, or churned out by someone because it's their job, or something like that. You know, there's that. It's just that little warm element of invitation to it that's really important, I think.
Hmm.
And these things do make a difference. I'll tell you what I did this week that was interesting, possibly, to someone, somewhere. Hmm. Is I changed... Alexa's name to Echo.
Oh, did you?
I did, yeah. And so I've been sort of exploring. So, you know, the device hasn't changed at all. It's still a female voice talking back to me in exactly the same way. But the fact that I don't call it Alexa, and instead I call it Echo, just makes it feel different.
Does it feel less feminine or just...
Yeah, yeah, it feels less to do with that, whereas... With her previous name, she was female. Now it's more machiney, which is nice because that's what it is. So it's kind of like it, sort of thing.
I think you're setting us up for the next link here.
I'm always doing that. I always keep something up. What is
this? Did you see this? this was really interesting. So this is.
Oh, all right, yeah.
This was widely shared.
It was. I read this with interest.
So this is on the Huffington Post. So I mean, interestingly, when you read, so I shared the Huffington Post one here, but you can click through and read the original story.
Yes, which I did.
And the original story has been done as a series of Twitter moments, which I've never used before. But it's basically a bit like, what's that curated? Storify. Yeah, it's really like Storify.
Yes. Yeah. It's Storify, but then this is...
So what this guy did was, they had a shared email inbox, And what was happening was that there were consultants for this firm, and the feeling was from management was that the female consultant just was working too slowly. And why was she working so slowly and taking longer to get the work done than her male counterparts? And it's like, it says, so one day I'm emailing a client back and forth about his resume, and he's just being impossible, rude, dismissive, ignoring my questions, telling me his methods were the industry standards. They weren't, and I couldn't understand the terms he used. I could. Anyway, I was getting sick of his shit when I noticed something. Thanks to our shared inbox, I've been signing all communications as Nicole. It was Nicole he was being rude to, not me. So out of curiosity, I said, hey, this is Martin. I'm taking this project over for Nicole. Immediate improvement. Positive reception, thanking me for suggestions. Response promptly saying, great questions, became a model client. Note, my technique and advice never changed. The only difference was that I had a man's name now. So basically, they ran an experiment for a week, and he said it was utter crap. Utter crap. And when she switched to being male name, all of a sudden, her work, you know, was the same speed as her male counterparts.
I think, so my experience of like managing people and working with people and things, I didn't think this when I first read it. And I think the impact of what they're saying, I think holds water. And, but there is a certain sense about which people like the second iteration of stuff. So if we were to go into a project and either you went first or I went first, and then we just switched it around and we knew that we were always going to do that. But it kind of gets to a stage where it's a little bit new broomy, you know, it's a little bit, are we here? You know, things aren't going quite what you, or whatever it might be. And people like that. It's a human response. It's like, okay. But also the person, once they're on the second iteration, the client or the recipient or the other person can't complain as much because they've spoken and things have changed. And you know, there's a little possibility. So what I guess I'm talking about is kind of Hawthorne effect of this experiment. But you know, you change something and you get much better results. However, the article does say that throughout the 2 weeks that they did this, the impact was significant throughout the work. So he had the worst 2 weeks of his working life, or the 1 week in particular, I think, and she had the best. And that was that. And I also thought what was interesting is when she talks about her boss's reaction when they revealed this, and how, because this, you know, this is a possible spotlight on the idea of institutionalized misogyny and sexism, and which I'm a big fan of, the idea of these things, racism as well, being becoming institutionalized, that you really do have to understand the context of how the genders have, how industry and the workplace has evolved, and the gender roles that have occurred within that, and the fact that women have only had the vote for a very short amount of time, relatively speaking, and similar with racism, you have to look at slavery and hundreds of years of that oppression and sort of barbaric treatment of people due to their skin color, and to understand how these things have entrenched, because everyone says, well, I'm not sexist, I'm not racist. Well, yeah, you are. You know, that's the deal. That's the point. The point is that the fact that you've grown up in this society and not being part of the minority means that you are. And this is a big deal. And this is an example of how you can kind of showcase that, I think, illustrate it, you know, because and I'd love to see much more of this going on, kind of thing.
Yeah, those kind of experiments. Yeah, I think that'll be interesting. Yeah, because you don't know what you don't know, and you don't know how. Because we all, especially to do with email, because nobody, unless you show them or you have a shared email inbox, you don't see anybody else's email inbox.
Well, that's the other fascinating thing about this, is that they can do it with that level of anonymity.
Mm.
So you could, because the, you know, normally people would have the inboxes tied to their name, because their name would be their email address. So to flip it around would take some technical genius, but that doesn't exist really, and they had this sort of unique opportunity to be able to do this, and you know, it's just like Shakespeare. Do you know what I mean?
I wonder what it's like for people who have gender neutral names.
Well, this is a thing, right? So if somebody books a hotel for me, this has happened to me on several occasions. So they book a hotel on my behalf, and it's not me doing it for myself. And they give my name, and but they don't give my title, then I get put down as Muz.
Do you?
Yeah.
Or because they hear it as DI, as in short for Diana.
Exactly. So, so they assume that I'm a woman, and that's quite interesting. And I rock up, and I've actually had conversations with people where I've had to tell them I'm not a woman. Like standing, no, that is me. It's not. I'm not a woman. I'm called Di. Yeah, that's your name. Yes, it's my name. And blah blah blah. So it's quite entertaining, really. So, yeah. I don't know, but it should be, people are entrenched in their own thoughts sometimes.
Well, talking about people being entrenched in their thoughts, another nice segue there. Commenting on the internet is a fraught, an activity, kind of, it's a fraught activity. So people don't read things, comment based on their existing prejudice, etc. And this, I think this was published just after, right at the start of March. Have we covered this before? No.
No.
So it's Neiman Labs. Neiman is a journalist resource, I guess. And it says, 2 weeks ago, NRK Beta, the tech vertical of the Norwegian public broadcaster NRK, published an explainer about a proposed new digital surveillance law in the country. Digital security is a controversial topic, and the conversation around security issues can become heated. But the conversation and the comments of the article was respectful and productive. And the reason for this, and I've got screenshots in Norwegian, was because you had to answer a quiz about the content of the story before you were allowed to comment.
You see, that's just flipping marvellous, isn't it? Mm. I mean, it's really annoying. Like, but if you understand the content, it won't take you long. And I assume that it's, you know, will it actually decline you? Your ability to comment, I guess you could just go into a different IP address and go incognito or whatever and have another go at the quiz once you realize what you got wrong and what you need to get right. But it's a nice idea of being proven to be human.
Yeah, and linked in this actual post as like a you might also like is another one from the end of February, which the title of it is, this tool from Google's parent Alphabet tries to tackle toxic comments through machine learning. And of course, this is the difference, isn't it, between doing a human-centric approach, like, have you read this before you comment, versus, oh, we're going to spot trends to see what toxic language is like, and we're going to prevent people commenting based on machine learning.
Yes. And also it's the other thing, isn't it? It kind of filters the self. So if you have to go through and answer a quiz, first of all, you have to think, have I really understood this article? Second of all, you have to think, is it worth my bother hanging around and getting through this to say the thing that I need to say? So it changes your psychological perspective on your interaction with the web page and the article and the author by just resetting your mind a little bit. Do you know what I mean? It forces that to happen. So it makes you be more human rather than just be a human. It makes you be more human in your response, possibly.
Mm. It's funny, isn't it? So I feel like, I think both of them together could work quite well, actually, but I'm always in favor of the human approach.
I think so. I think that's a really important thing with all the automation that's coming our way, that has happened and more to come of the workplace, you know, in reference to your book earlier, what digital employability is.
Yeah.
We're going to have to identify the human things. What, you know, what is it that you need a human to do? What is it that we want a human to do and don't want a computer to do?
Mm.
And these things are going to have to be identified. And obviously conversation is one of those things. Imagine if we started... Imagine if computers started commenting on human posts. What would that serve? You know, what would be the purpose of it, other than to actually evolve? I guess a computer could spot holes in an argument, possibly much faster and more efficiently at times than a human, and push people in the right direction when they've written nonsense. And that's why Google are pursuing the machine learning methodology. But this is just a whole different approach, which is kind of like, you know, take a chill pill and make sure you understand what you're talking about before you write. Maybe.
No, I think so. I think that's the way forward. I mean, it's one of those things I've considered removing comments from my blog Because whereas, I suppose it was in pre-proper social media days, I used to get 30 comments on stuff, and some people still do, which is great. But the comments I get now are just like pointless. People having not read it, or saying in 2017, like, badges will never take off, they'll never be a thing. You think, oh, for goodness sake, just what's the point in saying this? I always like to reply to everything, but it just seems like a waste of time. Whereas, yeah, if I put a quiz on it, I mean, Audrey Waters removed her comment section because it was just ridiculous.
It's interesting. I was sent an email this week by one of my colleagues who I'm on a working party with about Screen Time that I've mentioned before. He's a housemaster. And in the email, he included the lookup video. Do you remember that?
Sorry, he included the what?
The lookup video. Look up from your phone.
Yes.
Do you remember that?
It's
a viral thing. It's had 60 million views. Mm. It's a long time ago. Mm. Anyway, and another Hosm replied, obviously the irony that they're using technology to share something that's about not using technology. But the gentleman question highlighted his own irony. Another person replied that she didn't know why she was tired because she'd been writing reports, but it had moved her to tears. And it's so over emotive and full of rubbish, this video.
Yeah.
It does things like, it has this very emotive music playing in the background.
Yes.
It does things about, there's this old man holding the hand of his dying wife in bed. So by implication, he's suggesting that by using your mobile phone, you're not going to, hold the hand of your wife as she's dying or something. You know, it's just like really quite crazy.
Well, it's all total bollocks, and it's by people who don't get the culture. So I've been showing my parents how to use Telegram because mm-hmm. I've found that even though I use Signal with some people, most of my family like using Telegram. So I use it with my wife, and I've also shown my parents how to use it as well. And it's great because obviously I can now get the double tick like on WhatsApp, etc. But when my dad was in hospital, it meant that he was less alone because I was having Telegram conversations with him.
Yeah, no, but this is the point, isn't it? I mean, it's complete rot. So I'm thinking about making something in response to look up.
Look down.
Look down. You will know. Look out is what I was going to actually do, because that's really what I want people to do. I want them to look out and see how technology is actually being used and see it for themselves. Because I get a real concern where you have adults telling children what to do with tools that they've never used.
Definitely.
And I have a real problem with that, which is difficult, and it's really hard to get over to them that a telephone or the internet is not just used for bad things or for wasting time.
Mm. I don't know if you saw on the Slack channel this week, someone, and this relates to the digital employability stuff as well, Jay mentioned that there are people in his organization in their early 20s who have never used a Windows machine.
All right.
Because, you know, they had Macs at school or Chromebooks, you know, they had Macs at home. And so they're going into enterprise environments and being shown how to use Windows. Then, of course, you've got the people in the organization who are the exact opposite of that. And there's almost like a talking past one another in terms of tech.
Yes, and that's the thing, isn't it? Because when you talk tech, when you have a conversation about it, you don't discuss the detail of the actual kit you use. And
he described it... Someone said, "What's that?" And it was Outlook. And they said, "Well, what's that for?" Because they only ever use Gmail. And they said, "Well, imagine a spreadsheet, but for email." Which I thought was a hilarious way of explaining.
Fantastic. I've been talking about, we don't use Gmail on our Google Suite, and I've been talking to someone about that earlier this week. And I just put the massive eyebrows, turned up nose, all of that from someone I'm very good friends with. It was very funny.
Really?
And I'm just like, you obviously don't use Gmail. You don't know the difference between these two clients, and it's so vast. And it helps you. You know, it helps you get your stuff done.
No, I have to say, so I don't use Google for my personal email. But for my business stuff, my dynamic skill set one, I use Google Inbox on my phone and on the web. And if it wasn't for that, being able to put a pin in it and remind to do this and move that to my Trello board if it's big enough, I would lose everything. I wouldn't get replies done.
Yeah, this is the thing, isn't it? So it serves as this fantastic reminder, and Google's getting a little bit more intelligent. So I'm organizing. I'm going to Bangkok and India at the Easter holidays. So I've been organizing flights and the trip and things like that. So I've been using Google Keep for, like, I've never been to India before, so I kind of need to know what the hell to do. And Google has this lovely thing where the emails become really large and, like, itinerary-like when your flights come in, because it's really important. And I really like the fact that they kind of just know that, and it doesn't sit there the same as every other email.
Yeah, you can go to flights and stuff. Yeah, it makes a big difference to my life, because obviously I'm traveling quite a lot.
Exactly. And just see that it comes in, it punches you a little bit in the face and wakes you up and pay attention to that. Yes, that's important.
Yeah, exactly.
Things like that.
Talking about Google, they announced yesterday that Google Classroom is no longer going to be tied to just G Suite for Education. And the way that they're spinning this is that it's useful for parents, homeschooled children, community centers who are doing after-school programs for coding, that kind of thing. So you can use Classroom with any Google account.
You can add, if you want, you've got some people. I have examples of this. I have a pupil who's left the country for 18 months, and he's in one of my classrooms, in my Google Math classrooms. But his school accounts are on ice. He's apparently coming back for sixth form, but that's not confirmed until it actually happens. He's in Hungary. And so he can maintain and look after, be part of our class nonetheless.
Really like Google Classroom. And as you know, I did quite a lot of training on it at Victoria College in Jersey. Really easy to use. But there is a certain logic to it, which I think is quite command and control and structured.
Yeah, no, it is all of that, really. And I use Classroom and with the majority of my classes. And the stuff that it doesn't do yet, which is quite interesting. So it doesn't have a mark book, for example. So you, like, you grade your, you know, give your feedback and grade your work or whatever, and it doesn't link to the pupil or to a central place where you can see whether people have logged things in or not. You have to keep quite on top of it yourself. The notifications are poor as to the submission of work. So you get a notification in your diary about the deadline for a piece of work, but that's not when you need to check it. You kind of need to check it after the deadline has passed. Yeah. And that's the sort of sensibility that Google...
It doesn't have, because they're all techies. But if I was running... If I was doing something, especially out of school, my default thing would be, hey, let's use a wiki, because then you're building it collaboratively and it ends up being a knowledge repository rather than, oh, wipe the slate clean, now there's the next class because it's next year, etc.
Yeah, I think that's true, but I completely concur with that. But you and I are not the people that that Google are catering toward. You know, they're catering toward people who don't know how to use tech.
I suppose not. It was funny, actually. My daughter was invested into beavers this week. She just started because she's old enough, which is great. So we were invited along to witness the investiture. And the hilarious thing is, my wife is a primary school teacher. And, in a Cubs Beaver Scout situation, there's a element of organized chaos, isn't there? And she couldn't cope with it. Like, because it was kids of an age that she teaches in a less structured, more informal environment, she was getting almost twitchy. It was funny.
Oh, okay.
And I feel like it's a bit like, if all of a sudden, the Beavers and the Cubs and the Scouts were a bit more regimented, a bit like in the CCF or something like that, she would be more comfortable. If they were using Google Classroom instead of some free form thing, she'd be more comfortable. Now, I guess it's what you're used to, isn't it?
I think it is. So I've been training today, as I mentioned earlier, at lunchtime, and I'm training, I'm talking to people who are using these new devices that we've brought in, like Surface Pro, iPad Pro, Surface Book, and Chromebook Pixel, and they're using three different teaching and learning management systems, which these are. Classroom, Google Classroom is one, Microsoft OneNote Classbook is another, and Firefly is another. Now, Firefly have just upgraded to version 6, and they're not on top of their game, I think is fair to say, in public. And so put that one out of the way. And then you're looking at the differences between the two classrooms. And so, say going forwards, both of these products are very successful and they meet the needs of the teachers who are trialing them. What you're looking at really is an investment in skill set. So once, you know, the devil is in the detail. Once someone's learned the detail of one system, they're reluctant to move to another. So we might be the first school in the history of the world to have two teaching and learning management systems officially used within the school. So in conversations that I've had with people on Twitter, maybe, and things like that, people are saying, no, you go with one as your core product, and then you go with the other as, like, you can bolt this on if you want to. Whereas we would, the approach that I'm entertaining rather than committing to is that a department would choose a teaching and learning management system of their own.
So the two you're discussing are Firefly and G Suite?
So Google Classroom and Microsoft Classroom, as it will be, although we have...
Oh, I see, right, okay.
Oh, right. Yeah.
I suppose, I can see where people are coming from, because there's certain features, for example, in Google Classroom, without wanting to go too deep into a particular proprietary, even though it's free product, is you can turn on parent digest on a weekly basis. Which
I counseled
against doing that at Victoria College, because they weren't at a stage where all teachers were using it. And I, as a parent, would be wondering why, I don't know, science were using it and English weren't. And I wasn't getting updates about my child's progress in all areas. And I guess you'd be missing out on that.
I'd take a different tack on that, right? I think. I'd want the conversation anyway. About pupil privacy. So when is a pupil's work private? When are they allowed to sort of slip up and not get into trouble at home?
Yeah.
And that kind of thing. When are they allowed to make mistakes? And do those mistakes have to be laid naked in front of their teacher adults and their parent adults as well? It's kind of hard graph. So, there's a certain element to which I'd say, school business is school business, and if we've got a problem, we'll let you know.
Well, yes, no, yeah. I agree with that, definitely. I've on a small scale witnessed that with my own son, even though the school's down the road. But obviously it's a lot different for you, because you're in loco parentis most of the time, goes to boarding school.
Yes, when they're here all the time.
Yeah.
So, 24/7, so it's...
But I do very much appreciate what you're trying to do in terms of preserving people's autonomy and professional choice.
Yeah, I think it is that, because the third system would be to use neither, obviously. And because I don't want to insist that teachers use technology if they don't think it's adding value to what they do. I want them to prioritize what they feel to be things of most value in the learning that they lead.
Going back to that podcast of Audrey Waters and Kin Lanes that I was talking about before, they made an interesting point about how educators who in their personal life would think themselves as being progressive feel, in her experience, she was saying that they feel that because they're using technology in their professional practice and education, they feel like they're being progressive there too, but they're using command and control technologies which surveil students and therefore are falling into the hands of the opposite of being progressive, in kind of the command and control military style conservative military industrial complex, which was interesting. Moving on anyway, something I saw that Alan Levine tweet out was the Sideways Dictionary this week, which I thought was a great idea.
Well done, CogDog. Absolutely, this is great. So I really like this. It's basically a dictionary where people have defined technological terms by using analogies, and it's kind of great. So I'll give you an example. If we look at Bitcoin, it says it's like digital gold. There is a finite Bitcoin supply that can be mined every year by using sophisticated software, not a pick and shovel. And like gold, you can exchange it from one person to another without the need for a bank.
Yeah, exactly. Using metaphors helps people understand. There's some funny ones as well. One for BitTorrent is, it's like Panini sticker albums. So BitTorrent obviously being the way that you download legal and illegal stuff via swarms of people. It's like Panini sticker albums where the whole world is made up of avid collectors, each trying to complete their own sets. You let people know what you need and what you have available, swaps, and the system shuffles the stickers around the planet at supernatural speed.
That's kind of super. Yeah, there's another one here about Bitcoin. It's like Tinkerbell, the fairy who only exists if enough children believe she exists. Bitcoin only works if enough people believe that it works. You could argue the same is true of all currencies, which indeed you could.
Cool.
So it's worthwhile. So I haven't got to the bottom of this yet, but it's certainly something that you could do with your class sort of thing. It's like define this without defining it. You know, use an analogy of some sort to define it. It'd be a great sort of activity to do with children.
It's actually a project of, is it the New York Times, the Washington Post, and Jigsaw, which is part of Google, I think, is it? I don't know.
Jigsaw.
I'm not sure, but
Jigsaw is, yeah. I'm
late. Yeah, so it's a great idea. You can add your own analogy if you want to. There's one on Wiki, which is Wiki is like a sausage. Wikipedia founder Jimmy Wales told a reporter in 2004 that Wikipedia is just like a sausage. Quote, you might like the taste of it, but you don't necessarily want to see how it's made. End of quote.
Yes, absolutely right.
Anyway, have a look if you're listening. It's great.
Yes, it is. Really fabulous.
I mentioned the New York Times there incorrectly, but something which is in the New York Times is, why are the highly educated so liberal? So, Di, why are you so liberal?
I never think of myself like this.
You have a master's. You work in posh school with academic rigor.
Liberal. I actually is both things, highly educated or liberal. I just don't think of myself as either of those things.
Okay.
They're things that I have to, they're like doors. You know, you just come across them one day and you think, oh, I am highly educated. That's me. I didn't realize. And, but I can't argue. Like, what does, yes, no, that means that. And I have to say that I am that. Oh, I'm liberal. I'm good. This is my door. Okay.
Yeah.
It's a bit like that. But it's an interesting thing when you start looking at filter bubbles, I think. And I think something to do with my age as well. So all the people I know nearly are highly educated and liberal, nearly all of them. So the filter bubble that exists on different social media platforms is very much full of the same people just like me. And it's quite interesting. And I have certain people on Facebook, actually, more than anywhere else, that are not liberal, and they're not highly educated, and they're former pupils, and they were taught by me, so clearly they're not highly educated. And friends as well, who just had a different walks of life and things like that. And the stuff they post is entirely different. It's all about what's, like, crude, rude, and funny. And that's what they post in the main. It's interesting.
Yeah.
This
particular thing is it's actually been quite a recent shift that the Pew Research Center notes. So it says, quote, last month, the Pew Research Center released a study showing that nearly a third of those who went to graduate or professional school have down the line liberal views on social, economic and environmental matters, whereas this is true for just 1 in 10 of Americans generally. An additional quarter of postgrads have mostly liberal views. These numbers reflect drastic change. While professionals have been in the Democratic column for a while, in 1994, only 7% of postgrads held consistently liberal political opinions. End of quote.
1994, that's not long ago.
No. So what he is, this guy, Dr. Gouldner, who's analysed this kind of stuff, he is saying, as he saw it, beginning in the early 20th century, increasing complexity in science, technology, economic affairs and government meant that the old moneyed class no longer had the expertise to directly manage the work process or steer the ship of state. Members of the old class turned to scientists, engineers, managers, human relations specialists, economists and other professionals for help. As these experts multiplied, they realized the extent of their collective power. They demanded fitting levels of pay and status and insisted on professional autonomy. A new class was born, neither owner nor worker. And he's saying that basically a distinguishing feature of this new class is a culture of critical discourse. And he assumed that this culture of discourse existed in this rarefied atmosphere of postgraduate study. But that as soon as they went into the workforce, that would kind of dissipate. But actually, that hasn't happened, and people remain highly educated, obviously, because they've gone through university, but they retain that kind of left-leaning liberal sympathies, even though they're in quite conservative places.
Yes, and I think that all kind of makes sense. I'm very conscious of the fact that as I grew up, I was encouraged by subcultural media, such as Red Wedge and Amnesty International, anti-apartheid, anti-Thatcher rhetoric in general, to spit against this sort of thing, the idea of there being an elite class that deserved to be there in some way and that they should be respected for that. But also, quite often, the upper classes were aligned to the working classes because there's sort of a common bond in just accepting life as it was, and it's just the way it is. And it's the middle classes that really are the liberals, and that kind of thing. But but certainly, I was encouraged to have, you know, I did three essays in my finals for economics, and I critiqued Thatcher in each of them. That was the core of the essay, was criticizing her policies. And in different ways. And it's interesting. So I certainly got with that.
The thing I find interesting is people don't often explicitly say this, but there's an implicit assumption with a certain mindset of certain people I know, which is, hey, this is the way the world works. And if you're a parent, why would you not prepare your kids for the way that the world works? And why would you not yourself just accept the way the world works and do your best in the way that things are? And that's entirely reasonable. So I guess, I think there's an Orwell quote about the unreasonable man, isn't there?
No, there is. Ian Yorston blogs under the unreasonable man.
It's something, it's the reasonable man adapts himself to the world. The unreasonable one persists in trying to adapt the world to himself. George Bernard Shaw.
Well, it's like my father. My father, I think I said this not that long ago, my father has a thing where he says there are two types of people in the world, those that make it go round and those that change it.
Yeah, exactly. So I want to be someone who changes it. I don't think anybody, not just me, I don't think anyone should accept the way the world is structured. And I think everyone should try and change it for the better, in line with their own kind of mission and manifesto, either, you know, whether they've written that down or not, if it's just in their head. But it's really interesting, when I'm almost finished reading that book, SBQR, The History of Ancient Rome, which I started when I was over in Rome.
Yeah.
And what's really interesting is that that is evident in people who led the Roman Republic, either as emperors or before that. There were certain people who said, look, this is just the way the world is. And others were like, no, I think we can change this. And I think it's just I don't want to say it's a hard dichotomy, but it seems to be certainly, certainly evident at the two ends of the spectrum.
Well, you see, the truth of it, I think, is that my father was incorrect, and that everyone is both. And so you can't help but make the world go round. And I certainly, in my life, don't try and make it stop. But I also do try and change it in alignment with my what's about the world and what is it? What is a good world?
Have you stepped away from the microphone? I can't hear you very well.
Sorry, no, I haven't. Am I okay?
Yeah, that's better now.
Okay, just yeah, I was looking somewhere else, but not far away. So yeah, you have this idea. You know, I think you do this as well. You know, you make the world go round, and you try to.
No, I think that's fair enough. There's areas of your life where you think, actually, I'm not willing to compromise on this. But there's other areas of your life where you're like, you know, whatever, just give me the stuff.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I'll just accept it the way it's pitched and just enjoy it for what it is.
Yeah. And that can be a small thing. Well, small for me, I guess, big for other people. Like, I'm not just going to eat prepackaged food. I'm going to cook all my stuff from fresh. I'm not compromising on that. Whereas I'd be like, well, whereas me compromising on my technology is not going to happen. So yeah, I think you're right. Everyone is both.
Yeah.
Talking of types of people and organizations and stuff, there was an interesting post that I think it was Craig McVerry shared in our Slack channel. It was from an organization called WeShare, as in OUI, like the French oui. And this is an organization that I have come to know through the work of the cooperative. And this particular post is, cut the bullshit, organizations with no hierarchy don't exist.
It's an interesting idea, isn't it? Because people who've worked in organizations with no hierarchy successfully will say that they do. So you look back at, let me think. So Bob Noyce and Intel, when it was a startup and he grandfathered Silicon Valley and all that, kind of thing, working in an organization without hierarchy. I think the principle is surely that what the movement behind a sort of flat, moving towards a flatter hierarchy is one that irons out, the layers of formal communication channels. And I think that encouragement is done to allow all, members of an organization to participate in the conversations that happen within that organization. And one might argue that it's about being a little bit more open. So working in a flatter hierarchy is a more open experience or process than working in a very strict hierarchy sort of thing. One of the things at the conference, actually, that somebody said is about leadership is that saying that your door is always open is not leadership.
No, exactly.
Because, and that's a means of attempting to flatten the hierarchy and show that your attitude. But actually, you have to get out of your chair. So this guy said you had to schedule into your diary the times when you were going to go and see them, whether it go and have lunch with teachers or go and be in a department meeting or go and walk around classrooms or whatever it might be. But you had to get yourself out there into the school. Not just say, my door's always open.
Yeah, that shows that you don't understand the kind of power relationship. Now, this post, you know, it's fine, whatever, but actually I think that if you just, there will be no need to write it if you just put one word into the title. So it says, organizations with no hierarchy don't exist. Well, as they point out later on, it's organizations with no static hierarchy don't exist, because what they talk about is dynamic hierarchy. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Which is entirely like in our co-op. I know it's only four of us at the moment, but that's the way that we work. Who's CEO of our co-op? Nobody. But who takes the lead if it's something to do with like more techie stuff and community-oriented stuff? Laura, if it's anything to do with visual stuff. Brian, if it's to do with partnerships or co-op stuff. John, if it's to do with like getting people to the meeting and organizing thinkathons. Me. So, it depends on what it is you're trying to do.
Sorry, did you just declare yourself company secretary?
Basically, well, our company secretary is actually my wife, but yeah.
No, I know. I'm only joking.
I'm more like everyone else's PA, but yeah.
So yeah, I think that's fine. I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? It's just a call for more flexible hierarchy within an organization to allow you to let the person with the expertise in a certain area come forward and take a leading role when as appropriate, I guess.
Well, there was a big thing.
It's not what you've got. You've got something different. Yours is a flat hierarchy.
Ours couldn't survive adding more people to it.
No, that's an interesting thing, isn't it? It is to do with size.
And it's also dependent, not just on size. Well, this is a function of size as well, but the strength of our previous relationships before we joined into the co-op.
Yeah, big deal.
Yeah. There's a thing which is the top highlight on this post, which is rather than removing bosses from the workplace, I think their role needs to evolve to that of a facilitator, coordinator, and leader, which is the kind of servant leadership model of, who was it, Daniel Goleman or someone like that?
Okay. My eye was drawn to an essay that was written by Joe Freeman, cited in this article, called The Tyranny of Structureless Children. And she basically says...
Yeah, that's quite a famous essay which reflects on feminist... groups in the 1970s, was it?
Okay. I don't know. Structurelessness in groups. And that smacks to me of the difference between how adults see school and how children see school. So adults see schools full of groups without structure, you know, structureless groups, whereas children see school as entirely hierarchically structured, like their peers are hierarchically structured, and they sit within that hierarchy, and every day they are dealing with their position in that hierarchy, and whatever that might be.
And it's amazing how persistent that is, isn't it? Because I went out for lunch with my parents yesterday, and on a table next to us was a group of women in their 60s and 70s, and there was, I could tell within 5 minutes there was a definite pecking order in that group.
Yeah, because it's just that is what goes on, and so every social group that I've participated in is a bit like that, and the best groups are the ones that it feels like that sometimes, and then you realise actually that's just bullshit. Mm. It's not really
the thing that you link to, which I haven't read for a while. I read a couple of years ago actually, The Tyranny of Structurelessness, because it's often referred to by the open source. In the open source movement, but it talks about how, and this is kind of the appeal of Trump as well, people will campaign on a platform, and when I say campaign, could be just the way that they act rather than actually an election process. Uh-huh. But they kind of, it says, like many of these informal elites have been hiding under the banner of anti-elitism and structurelessness. To effectively counter the competition from another informal structure, they would have to become public, and this possibility is fraught with many dangerous implications. Thus, to maintain its own power, it's easier to rationalize the exclusion of the members of the other informal structure by such means as red baiting, reforms, whatever. But what Bud's saying is that people do the exact opposite of the thing that they say they're doing, which happens in every organization, whether it's a football club or it's a school.
Indeed. Interesting. Interesting stuff.
Yes. Right. The thing which I was very much looking forward to getting to was this Guardian article by a guy who survived in the wilderness in Maine, USA, for 27 years by himself.
That's right. So when I first looked at the links this evening, and please appreciate that I'm quite tired and had a busy, busy day. And the set of links, never mind the text within them, was like a forest. And the one that stepped out to me was this, and it's a fascinating article. What on earth was the book I read about the guy who goes off? I can't remember what it was. I read it last summer. the guy goes off up in the north of...
Oh, it was turned into a film. Christopher McCandless, was it? Someone McCandless.
Yes, that's the guy. I can't remember what
It's called Into the Wild?
Into the Wild, that's it. And so it's a little bit of a story like that. This guy of 20 years old just walked away from his life. He gave up his job, didn't take his tools back, got his backpack and his tent in his car, spent some time driving around living in cheap motels, and eventually worked his way up to Maine. So he went down to Florida and down the East Coast and then went back up again up to Maine. And then just put his car keys on the dashboard, drove next to a wood, put his car keys on the dashboard in his car, and took his tent and backpack and walked. That was that. And I haven't finished this article because it's one of the Guardian's long reads, but it's absolutely fascinating.
Well, the interesting thing for me is actually the bit where it kind of gets into the kind of philosophical, spiritual, meditative side of his, you know, being alone for 27 years. But just to pick out some things which might be of interest, he had a strong kind of moral sensibility. So started off by eating a road-killed partridge raw, which obviously made him ill. He said he was raised with rigid morals and a great deal of pride. You make do on your own always. No handouts or government assistance ever. You know what's right and what's wrong, and the dividing line is usually clear. But then, you know, he didn't eat for 10 days. And the only job he'd ever had as a 20-year-old was fitting locks, and kind of theft deterrent systems. So he knew how they worked. And so he would observe people and meticulously in detail so that he knew when they were in, when they were out, all this kind of stuff. And he would steal just enough. And there's one bit where he talks about the hot shame that he felt even after 27 years of breaking into people's houses, and the police describing just how amazing he was at making sure that he was never caught. But eventually he was caught as a 47-year-old after being by himself for 27 years. But that's I'm amazing. Not going to go on.
No, it's just amazing. I just think it's fascinating how he could do that. I don't know how he could. He talks about when he was 20, he knew that he liked his own company, and he was okay with being alone. He didn't really have any friends or anything in his workplace. And he left his family and didn't ever speak to them for 27 years all of this time. You know, they just assume he's dead, I'm assuming. and these things are all difficult. That's a big gig. But he says here something that I sympathize with, that he soon lost track of where he was and he didn't care. He would camp in one spot for a week or so and then head south yet again. And to quote him, he says, "I kept going," he said. "I was content in the choice I had made." And that's a thing that I find at my age now, more important than I've found ever before in my life, is to be content with the choices I have made, to be peaceful with them and to rest with them and to not worry about them. But maybe I'm just at a stage of life where I don't have to make... that's what I'm seeking. I'm seeking a place where I make my decisions and I'm content with the choices.
I don't know if we talked about this on the podcast, but I did read something recently. I won't be able to find the link straight away, but it was talking about people's self-reported happiness as they get older, and people self-report that they are happier the older they get. And people wondered whether it's just they're not experiencing negatives in life, but they did some kind of test in terms of the way the brain, you know, what different things people are experiencing. And what it was people learning how to deal and not put such a emphasis on negative things that happen, kind of learning that bad things happen, but I'm going to focus on the things which make me happy, like, you know, you being content. So,
well, I think that's fine, but I do think that we spend a lot of time talking about how the world has gone to shit. And part of that is because for so many people in the world, they are not able to be in that position that you just described, because stuff is happening to them through the fault of other people, or indeed natural disaster, or just bad accidents, you know, or just bad luck. It puts a different perspective on things, your experience, I guess. And that's part of it. So that's one of the things I found living in London, that I was surrounded by so many people all of the time. And I was quite relieved to get away from that. And living in Andor, which is a community of 5,000, it's it just feels much more manageable in my mind, which is, you know,
No, definitely. I live in a town where I was saying to this to my wife yesterday, actually, that I see people every day, or almost every day, several times a week, who I've never spoken to before. I know nothing about their lives, but I feel like I know them because I see them so often. I've never even said hello to them. But I might have smiled at them, but that's it. And it's because I live in a town of, well, it's growing, but 16,000 people.
Yeah, exactly, and that is the way it goes. You don't need to.
I'm just going to read this bit actually because it's great. It's just a section of this long read, like you said. So, forgive me this bit because I did quote it actually on my Discourses blog. So this guy is called Christopher Knight. It says, quote, Knight said that he couldn't accurately describe what it felt like to spend such an immense period of time alone. Silence does not translate into words. It's complicated, he said. Solitude bestows an increase in something valuable. I can't dismiss that idea. Solitude increased my perception. But here's the tricky thing. When I applied my increased perception to myself, I lost my identity. There was no audience, no one to perform for. There was no need to define myself. I became irrelevant. The dividing line between himself and the forest, Knight said, seemed to dissolve. His isolation felt more like a communion. My desires dropped away. I didn't long for anything. I didn't even have a name. To put it romantically, I was completely free. Virtually everyone who has tried to describe deep solitude has said something similar. I am nothing. I see all, wrote Ralph Waldo Emerson. Lord Byron called it the feeling infinite. The American mystic Thomas Merton said that the true solitary does not seek himself, but loses himself. For those who do not choose to be alone, like prisoners and hostages, a loss of one's socially created identity can be terrifying, a plunge into madness. Psychologists call it ontological insecurity, losing your grip on who you are. Edward Abbey, in Desert Solitaire, a chronicle of 2 6-month stints as a ranger in Utah's Archers National Monument, said that being solitary for a long time means risking everything human. Knight, meanwhile, didn't even keep a mirror in his camp. He was never once bored. He wasn't sure, he said, that he even understood the concept of boredom. I was never lonely, Knight added. He was attuned to the completeness of his own presence rather than to the absence of others. If you like solitude, he said, you are never alone. End quote.
When was this guy arrested?
I'm not sure.
I think I've heard this story before.
You reckon?
Yeah, no. Not this story. This is an account of it. This has just been published, but it's... it doesn't say if he's just been arrested or not at the top. Really fascinating story, anyway. At the end of the article... You mentioned this before we started recording. So a journalist asked him, despite his difficulty, to share more of what he had gleaned whilst he was alone. Was there, the journalist asked him, some grand insight revealed to him in the wild? Knight sat quietly, but he eventually arrived at a reply. Get enough sleep, he said. I love that.
Oh, I found his Wikipedia article here. Knight entered the woods in 1986, age 20, without saying goodbye to anyone, and was captured during a burglary in 2013. His only human contact in that time was one exchange of trivial greeting with a hiker.
Yes, so I have. It is the same story. That's about the right time. Because he was caught in somebody's property, wasn't he? Excellent. Interesting. I'm fascinated by sort of solitude. And that sort of thing, so I just find it interesting.
Well, talking about the very last thing I think we're going to talk about today is something which was in the Boston Globe, which was the biggest threat facing middle-aged men isn't smoking or obesity, it's loneliness.
Well, that's fantastic because I smoke and I quite like to get fat someday. I've had to deal with loneliness in the last 3 years in a different kind of way, to be a little serious for a moment, I guess. But since I split up from the mother of my children, I found myself in four walls staring at them thinking, what do I do now? There's nothing I want to do. What do I do? And not having company and had to deal with loneliness like that. in a way that I've never had to really encounter before. And solitude has always been something I've wanted before, in a way. It's like, can I have some time alone to do the things I need, especially as a parent, when I just got no time alone. And so, it's interesting that, so I guess that's why I'm interested in it. I'm interested in how people deal with it, you know, which I don't think I would be able to. I think just the way I've evolved, or how I'm built, is that I like people. I like having people around me. I like having people to talk to.
But this guy, I mean, he's applying it to his own life. He says, you know, the editor said, oh, you'll like this story. You know, this one's perfect for you. And he's like, what are you talking about? I'm not a lonely kind of guy. Maybe you want to read this, but I don't know. It's talking about, since my wife and I have written about loneliness and social isolation.
Where's that?
He says, since my wife and I have written about loneliness and social isolation, we see, he's talking to a psychiatrist, we see a fair number of people for whom this is a big problem, Schwartz continues. But there's a catch. Often they don't come saying they're lonely. Most people have the experience you had in your editor's office. Admitting you're lonely feels very much like admitting you're a loser. Psychiatry has worked hard to destigmatize things like depression, and to a large part it's been successful. People are comfortable saying they're depressed, but they're not comfortable saying they're lonely because you're the kid sitting alone in the cafeteria.
Yeah. There's this thing about the children don't like ever walking anywhere alone because they don't like to be seen by other children alone.
Yeah.
It comments on them socially. I think it's interesting to say whether loneliness causes a chemical reaction in your body that is bad for you is an interesting concept. It's certainly never felt that way to me. I don't know.
So John Stuart Mill used to say that you can never say that you're whether or not you're happy, because as soon as you reflect on whether you're happy, you're primed to reflect that you're not happy. And so I think it's the same kind of thing with loneliness. If you reflect on, am I lonely? And this guy talks about how, you know, he doesn't feel lonely. There's plenty of couples that him and his wife goes out with, and says, well, that's fine until, you know, your wife gets the friends in the divorce. But for me, like, I could point to lots of reasons why people might think that I'm lonely, or might, on some bad days, I might think I'm lonely. But I don't feel like that, really.
Yeah, so loneliness is a mood is too wrong, but a temporary state for a little while, maybe. Mm. Let's put some data on this. So above the paragraph that you read out, it says using data from 3.5 million people collected over 35 years found that those who fall into the categories of loneliness, isolation, or even simply living on their own see their risk of premature death rise 26% to 32%, which is quite significant. Now consider that in the United States, nearly a third of people older than 65 live alone. By 85, that has jumped to about half. Add all of this up and you see why the Surgeon General is declaring loneliness to be a public health epidemic.
Well, there's two paragraphs that don't go together. Hey, if you live by yourself, you're at risk of premature death. Oh, but hey, like everybody over 65 lives alone.
Yeah. That's it. So you're at risk of premature death by 85. Well, I don't consider 85 to be premature.
No, exactly.
If I get there, I'm like, I'm going to high five someone just before I go, you know? Well,
it's one of those things that, yeah. I think it's
going to be interesting. And I think, you know, I talk about these virtual digital assistants like Echo and whatever, and how they are going to be company, you know, by the time...
I can't find the answer to the question.
Because you said Echo.
That's it. So they are going to... I mean, that's crap, right? And every time that machine doesn't operate correctly is incredibly frustrating, interestingly enough. But, you know, in 20 years' time, that stuff is going to be... it's going to be company. It's going to be good enough to talk to and make you feel like somebody else is around, even though you know it's not going to.
Well, it's like that dinosaur you were talking about in terms of holding it by the tail last time.
Yes, indeed. Mm-hmm. And,
There's another paragraph in here which I wondered whether it reflected your experience. In February, at a conference in Boston, a researcher from Britain's University of Oxford presented study results that most guys understand intuitively. Men need an activity together to make and keep a bond. Women can maintain friendships over the phone. My wife is capable of having long phone talks with her sister in Virginia or her friend Casey, who she sees in person almost every day, and I kind of look at it with amazement. I hate the phone. My guy friends seem to share my feelings because our phone conversations seem to naturally last about 5 minutes before someone says, "All right, I'll catch up with you later." Dudes aren't going to maintain a bromance that way, or even a once-in-a-blue-moon beer. We need to go through something together. That's why studies have shown men tend to make their deepest friends through periods of intense engagement, like school or military service or sports. That's how many of us are comfortable. End of quote.
Well, that's an interesting thing. I'm going to step outside our bubble a second here, right? So what you could do, rather than just like ringing up and having a chat on the phone, is you could invent some weird kind of notion to meet up on the phone and record your conversation.
Like a podcast.
Come up with some wacky name and a tune to go with it, and then just like chat about shit.
No, but you're absolutely right. Like, how weird would it feel if it was just like, yeah, Di, I'm going to ring you for 2 hours every That's Tuesday it. Night.
And we're going to discuss links that we found.
You're like, no. You weirdo.
Yeah, okay. All right, I'll catch up with you later. It's interesting, isn't it? Isn't that funny?
You need rituals and routines. That's the deal.
Yeah. And it's true. So I started off that thought thinking, oh, we're just like the women, you and me. And then I thought, actually, no. We made a podcast. No,
exactly.
Super. There we go. So maybe that sounds pretty real to me. And it's true. I think about my social life really at school. You know, this week I played football last night and then went out for a curry and beers afterwards. I played hockey on Monday night for the third time in my life. I went out for what did we have? Someone made lasagna. There was the common room bar and there were beers again. And, you know, you're doing things together all of the time. In the staff in my school, but I choose to do that. There aren't, you know, not everyone's doing that. I choose to do that, but I live alone, so I love that stuff because it gets me out. It gets me to see the thing. We do the thing. We have a beer. We have a drink. Chat. Blah, 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 go home. Fantastic. Absolutely perfect. It's interesting.
Cool. Right. Well, I'm glad that we're not lonely, and I'm glad that we found a way of having long phone calls where we don't feel like we're turning into women. This is all good.
So what are you up to?
This coming week. So I've got a period of time over the next couple of weeks where I am less busy in terms of client work. So what I'm doing is I'm doing business development. You know, just all that kind of bollocks. But more seriously, I've got the book proposal. I've got a couple of ideas that I think people could sponsor. I'm potentially, for the first time since being self-employed, putting in a grant proposal for some interesting work. And then after that, we've got a co-op day. We're doing a webinar with Educators Co-op. And then I've got a period of time in April, as soon as April begins, where I am running sessions, going to the cooperative conference, heading over to Northern Ireland, going to Canada, going to London, like going to Devon for Easter. So April is going to be crazy. So I'm taking some time to make sure I'm completely prepared for all the stuff I need to do in April.
Oh, okay. Mm.
What are you up to?
Cool. I'm doing something that's a bit bonkers on Saturday night. I'll tell you about it.
Does it involve a pig's head and no?
No, it doesn't. Although Outlook is just failing me now and I'm looking to get some links and I can't find them. But however, having said all of that, I'm doing a charity thing. Six pupils from my boarding house, two of them whom are my tutees, and two other boys from different boarding houses are going to lift in a 12-hour period 230 tons, which is pretty impressive, and they're going to do that for the Orbis charity, which is flying aeroplane eye hospitals, and 230 tons is the weight of one hospital.
Wow.
So they're going to do that from 10 p.m. on Saturday night to 10 a.m. on Sunday morning, and I am going to supervise them. And so there's a charity giving page, you know, a Virgin Giving page, that if anybody would like to donate to this, they'd look into
it. Yeah, stick that in. Stick that in. When does that, so people who are listening to this, maybe not as soon as it's released, when does it have to be done by?
You can do it after the event, but the event is actually on Saturday night, which will be the 18th.
And so how much does that mean that you're going to have to lift?
I'm going to have to lift nothing. I am going to have to lift my head off the pillow to go and help them and support them.
You're not even lifting?
I'm not lifting, no. The pupils are lifting. It's not me doing that.
Oh, disappointing.
Yeah. I don't do gyms. It's just not my life. That's that. Although there seems to be a problem with our email, so I can't get the links right now, but I'll send them to you. I'll put them in the show notes shortly. Yes, and they've done a lovely video as well. So you can watch the promo video that they've done for it, where they talk about what they're doing and why they're doing it, which they've done a good job on, which is cool.
So they've taken the lead on this?
Oh, no, nothing to do with me. They just asked me to help them out so they're allowed to do it, because they're all in fifth form, so 16 years old. And so they're just doing deadlifts to their 50 kilograms at a time to their waist, you see what I mean? And more floor to waist. And doing enough. So they have something like 4,700 reps to do, something like that. 4,200 reps to do, maybe, which is like 700 each within the 12-hour period. So the thing I like about it is it's a real challenge, because they have no idea the amount of cramp that they are going to get in their muscles. And so they have to be prepared with all different fuels and that kind of thing. Yeah. So it should be good.
Should be interesting. Good stuff. Okay. Right. Well, I will talk to you next week, hopefully, and we'll find a time to talk. Thank you very much for listening, everybody. And until next time, this has been Tide 78, The Random Show.
Take care, goodbye. Sit at the dock of a bay, watching the tide roll away. Ooh, sitting on a dock of a bay, wasting time.